The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. This week, we're going to return to the relationship between science and literature, which we touched on a few weeks back. The reason we're doing this is because of the huge response that that podcast, plus a couple of subsequent pieces about science fiction, have had from you, our listeners, and our readers. Do we need science fiction when science itself is so fantastical? And where does the literary novel fit into this cosmos? Then we'll move swiftly on to our fifth and final author from the shortlist to this year's Guardian First Book Award, who argues that sometimes it's being wrong that leads us to the right conclusions.
An infinite number of white swans could prove that all swans are white, but a single black swan can prove that your belief about the colour of swans is wrong.
There are some serious questions here. In fact, one author has got so obsessed by questions that he isn't even bothering with answers or statements at all. But does that make a novel?
How do you stand in relation to the potato?
It's very tasty to eat in lots of different ways.
Do children smell good?
No.
There's undoubtedly a sound scientific basis for the smell of children, which brings us neatly back to the discussion of the week, wither science writing. With me in the studio to talk their way around the issues, the novelist Simon Ings, whose last two works were critically acclaimed novel The Weight of Numbers and A Biography of Vision. And also our very own Richard Lee of the Guardian Books website. But this is how it all started. A recent podcast featuring Nick Lane, winner of this year's Royal Society Prize for Science Book of the Year, provoked the following comments from Des Green.
In an age where quantum, relativity and superstring theories have changed the face of science, it is all the more important that these incredibly exciting ideas are brought to a wider and necessarily less scientifically and mathematically astute public. The best way to achieve this is to treat science as a subject in narrative fiction, and to tease out the philosophical impacts that new discoveries imply for modern lives and minds.
A week later, an interview with the science fiction writer Hannu Rajyemi prompted this comment from GoTo100.
Science fact is so, so beautiful, though. Why bother with fiction when the lectures on physics by Feynman are out there, or even Climbing Mount Improbable by Dawkins? The poetry of physics, when explained by the greatest genius ever, seems to me to be unbeatable.
So we on the Guardian Books desk thought something interesting was clearly going on, and we asked SF blogger Damien Walter what he thought about it. His piece, Stranger Than Science Fiction, struck a geyser of opinion, which sounded rather like this.
Simon Singh has science writing just right in Fermat's Last Theorem. The trick is not to gush your delight at your own understanding of these masterworks, yet convey next to nothing of the details. It is to give those details in a way that takes the reader along, satisfied and wanting more.
Well, true literary realism is only possible if we actually have a correct understanding of the reality we're reflecting. Currently, we don't have this when it comes to understanding the human mind, and thus psychological realism in this context is a false realism. It's based on an understanding of human psychology that's already obsolete.
Still, I'd love to see more stuff like Andrew Crummy's Sputnik Caledonia. Excellent prose, marvellous characterisation, and yet some really clever philosophical exploration of ideas at the cutting edge of science.
Science fiction is so useful because it encourages us to delve into the possible future of cognitive science. Psychological subtext underpinning the characters can be extended to include things we do not yet understand about our minds. Where non-sci-fi and fantasy literary fiction is backwards-looking, fantastical literary fiction is forward-looking.
The real question is, why is the vast majority of SF so poorly written, formally conservative, and shallow?
Sounds like you haven't read very much SF. Pick your subgenre or your time period. Some of the 20th century classics are amazing. At the moment, I recommend Alistair Reynolds' amazing space opera series, set in the Revelation space universe. The writing is sharp and witty, the characters are complex and morally ambiguous, the science is well thought out, he's a PhD in physics, and there's no happy ending.
Lots of point to reading SF and not just science. Do read that too, duh. Didn't Einstein say something about the importance of imagination? I think SpongeBob did too, so you know good authorities.
As Terry Pratchett said in his wonderful Carnegie Medal acceptance speech, recent Discworld books have spun on such concerns as the nature of belief, politics, and even of journalistic freedom. But put in one lousy dragon and they call you a fantasy writer.
The great Terry Pratchett, as usual, has the last laugh in that selection of opinions from our blog commenters. They raise a number of issues which we're going to tease out in the studio. The big question, Simon, is what sort of literature is best equipped to help us understand the frontiers of thought? Is it the science writers? We've mentioned a couple of Richards there. That's Feynman and Dawkins. I could also add a few Steves, for example, Jones and Rose. Is it, on the other hand, literary novelists like Andrew Crumey or science fiction novelists such as Alistair Reynolds or Terry Pratchett? Your thoughts on this?
I think if you're addressing the frontiers of thought, then a well-written science book will carry you about as far as you can get without getting involved in the mathematics. There are some disadvantages to that approach, though. The chief one being that all the great science literature has an average shelf life of an unrefrigerated yogurt. These books date unbelievably quickly. I was rereading Daniel Dennett's Consciousness Explained, because there were a couple of things I needed to look up. And it staggered me how dated the book felt. And it's only 5 years old, if that. And it's because the debate that it sets and the terms of the debate that it sets have moved on and become more nuanced. Some bits of his program have been forgotten and neglected. Other bits have been developed by others. And so you find yourself reading something that feels as if it came from the 1970s. And it's extraordinarily difficult to value science writing as literature because it's very hard to get a snapshot of a series of works that take a snapshot of science as a whole. You've got one or two great examples, which by the time you've reread them or recommended them to friends are already out of date.
So why is this different to the novel?
The novel is a machine for engendering an emotional response. The old Philip Sidney line about poetry being there to teach virtue is not far off the point, really. So if you're going to use fiction to look at science, you have to give that fiction some emotional charge or it is virtually unreadable. It's a very, very uninteresting form. One of the problems with science fiction is that it's so incredible when it's good, but crashingly dull when it's bad. I mean, there are very, very few bad crime books that are as crashingly dull as a bad science fiction book. It's one of those. It's a formal problem. It's not a problem you're going to get around by your politics or your idea of art or aesthetics. It's a formal problem that's going to stay with science fiction for good.
Let's just take you back into your own work. Now, you've written both science fact books, so your biography of the eye, which has been issued in the States just now, isn't it,
yes,
this month,
right.
But under a new title, and your novel. Do they come from different parts of your brain? Do they fulfil different functions for you as a writer?
I think they do. I think there's a very clear split in my own mind. I can't speak for anyone else, but for my own mind, I do think they come from very different places. The register that you use when you're writing good science is a register that will kill your fiction stone dead, because it is a register that conveys your opinion in a winning way. And I can't think of anything worse in a novel than an author coming in full of winning opinions. I think there is a split, a very clear one, yes. Mm-hmm.
Richard, we've said that, or Simon has said that science writing dates very quickly. One of the things that our commenters said was that literary fiction is out of date because it's out, people tend to be older, it's out of context, out of touch with what's happening at the forefront of things.
The problem is that if you're trying to be up to date with what's going on in technology, technology keeps shifting. And if what you're interested in isn't being at the bleeding edge of technology, if you're interested in this emotional machine that Simon's talking about, then you're liable to take your eye off the ball in terms of how quickly things are moving in terms of technology. So literary fiction has a bit of trouble catching up with the vertiginous speed of the transformations. And I think that's a problem for literary fiction, because literary fiction is the novel in itself is trying to do something new at all times. And so if the science that it's working on, if the technological universe in which it's working is 10, 15, 20 years out of date, then that feels as if it's no longer relevant.
In our Guardian review of The Weight of Numbers, your novel, Simon, Chris Pettit, who reviewed it, came up with this very interesting line, which I'm going to quote, because actually I think there's a bit of stuff to unpick here. He said that its lineage extends from the colonial excursions of Conrad and Céline to the anthropological objectivity of J.G. Ballard, to Neal Stephenson's Cryptomicon, to the askance mix of fact and fiction in DeLillo, something more stringent and mathematical, at any rate, than the usual literary preoccupations. Usual literary preoccupations, Richard.
He may be gesturing towards a criticism of much contemporary fiction, especially in Britain, which is often characterised as boring Booker bait, in that it's kind of historical fiction, it's post-colonial.
Social realist.
Yeah, it's kind of gesturing at a bunch of issues that we all think are kind of important, but doing it very much through the lens of the past and very much in a kind of in a formulaic way, which is almost like a generic treatment, which is exactly the opposite of what literary fiction should be trying to do, trying to recreate something new. So, I mean, maybe science and perhaps even some of the tropes of science fiction might offer some sort of resources for a literary writer who's trying to do something genuinely new.
You would think of this, Simon, as a literary novel. You're not trying to do science fiction.
I'm not trying to do science fiction, no. But having finished it and had people's comments back on it, what I realised was that I'd brought a certain science fictional sensibility to the thing, in that I was prepared to take a very long view, a sort of look outside the planet, look at people in the round, look at masses of people as well as individual characters, look at big movements. Now, I don't think this is unique to science fiction, and I'm not sure that science fiction has made the best examples of that sort of thing, but I didn't find the shift from a more generic thriller-based, narrative-based science fiction structure to literary fiction formally difficult. I found it a heck of a stretch, because whenever you leave the bucket for the ocean, you suddenly discover that you've got a lot to learn. One thing that you said, Richard, which I wanted to pick up on, just as science fiction and fantasy are an opportunity for literary fiction, I also think that the absolute rejection of the modern is also a perfectly legitimate and actually very exciting and creative way forward. I think of the work of Rupert Thompson, for example. And Rupert Thompson has dedicated himself to stripping out the modern from his work. And he doesn't do it by evoking past ages. He does it by actually removing all those brand names, removing the visual and letting the reader's imagination run away with itself.
I mean, this is the thing about literary fiction. I mean, Sarah Crown had mentioned to me just now that the quote which she was sourcing, I think, from Kingsley Amis, though she wasn't sure whether it's just one of these things that has become said now, that if it's any good, then it's literary fiction, and if it's science fiction, then it's not any good. But the job of literary fiction, if it is doing anything at all, is to be good. And so there are, of course, many strategies to be good. I'm not suggesting that science or science fiction is the only strategy. It's just that in the constant pursuit of the novel, of the new, that literary fiction requires, that maybe it's an underexplored territory for some contemporary
novels. But I don't understand why science fiction isn't in pursuit of the new. Surely it is. It's in pursuit of new concepts, new universes.
But then you have the problem that it's the most emotionally conservative genre that's out there.
So you actually buy that line, do you?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. It's not conservative in its subject matter, but novels aren't supposed to have subject matter. They're supposed to be machines that do things. And I think that an awful lot of science fiction is emotionally stunted.
So you'd agree with the poorly written, formally conservative and shallow that one of our commenters came up with at the top?
Well, I wouldn't agree with it, because I'm lucky enough to have misspent too much of my youth searching out the good stuff. But I know exactly where that commentator is coming from. Anyone in science fiction who says they don't recognise that is living in a box, frankly.
But I think perhaps that reveals something about why you've shifted from writing things that were more science fiction to not. Because it seems to me that one of the things about science fiction that's interesting is that they don't really care quite so much about the emotional machine, as you put it. The emotional machine is not so important for science fiction writers. They're more interested in the ideas. And that's why someone like Ishiguro, who writes a book about genetic cloning, isn't really writing science fiction at all. Because he's actually interested in the characters, the prose, he's interested in the arc of the story, and not really in genetic cloning at all.
What's interesting is when science fiction writers move to literary fiction, when they move to literary fiction, they suddenly find themselves as writers, not as people, heaven's sake, but as writers, emotionally insufficient. They haven't developed the tools, the techniques to actually just say, he loved her. they're kind of embarrassed about that, that kind of broad statement. On the other hand, you have literary writers writing into science fiction, and the worst of them are the arrogant buggers who think it's easy. And they're the ones who don't understand that science fiction is a way of packing huge amounts of material into very small amounts of narrative. Frankly, when you're reading a science fiction book, you want to see, at best, how the way the rules of reality have changed and how that affects the characters. And what you find from literary writers quite often is that the characters are still recognisable, urban, deluded, middle-class types wandering around a world which every science fiction reader knows full well would have altered their psychology immeasurably.
This is one of the ways in which I was wondering whether your contention that science writing is the best way of understanding science might be challenged. In that, I mean, I'm thinking of a book by Alistair Reynolds, House of Suns, where he takes relativity, which is such a weird idea, so very, very seriously, and his characters respond to that, and their choices that they make, their emotional choices that they make, are so much guided by the utter weirdness of relativistic time and what it means to move fast and live long, that actually it's a way of getting that very scientific idea of the dilation of time into your bones in a way that no science writing exposition of that ever could.
I think that's an extremely good example. And I think that science writing can do that, but there's very few examples.
Finally, let's go back to our own commenters for some of their recommendations, because we are accepting in this conversation that there are good science fiction writers. Here is what our commenters will recommend to you.
Read Philip K. Dick, learn from the master, then throw in Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft.
Colin Tudge is an excellent science writer.
I would pick J.G. Ballard's The Drowned World, written in 1962, as an excellent example of how science fiction can offer us pictures of possible futures.
When Calvino turns his hand to speculative fiction in Cosmic Comics, you get a taste of what it should be like, form rising to the same dizzying heights as content.
I can't believe nobody's yet mentioned Stanislaw Lem. Great stories, great literature, mesmerising and profound ideas, and a fantastically wicked sense of humour.
Simon's giving a big thumbs up to that last suggestion. We'll have to all go out and buy it immediately. There are, anyway, a few books for you to get through over the next few months. Read them, make up your own minds, and please come back and re-engage in the discussion, which I'm sure will run and run for as long as there is science fiction, or indeed literary fiction, in this world. For those of you who've come to us through iTunes, we'll carry a reading list on the front page of this podcast on guardian.co.uk/books. Now, one species of writer that hasn't got a mention yet is the journalist, and that's the species we're visiting for our fifth and final interview for the Guardian First Book Prize. She is Catherine Schultz, and her book is called Being Wrong: Adventures in the Margin of Error. She was in London on tour a couple of months ago, and Richard Lee caught up with her.
What first got you started in the study of wrongology?
Interestingly, it was almost the opposite of one major life experience. It was, in fact, that the idea of wrongness kept cropping up in all of these incredibly disparate domains, and I almost didn't notice, and I was kind of studying and pursuing all of these very different ideas, and at some point I realized, and this part really was an epiphany, I realized that what they all had in common was this kind of subterranean theme of wrongness, and I instantly got very excited, because exactly what's so fascinating to me about this subject is that our attitude toward being wrong is so influential in so many domains of life, you know, our personal lives, our political life, science, religion, really you name it. And yet it is quite subterranean. We never sort of pull it up and isolate it as a lens through which to look at the world. And I got excited about the possibility of doing so.
You argue with a host of intriguing anecdotes and telling psychological studies that the traditional model of error, that it's an aberration we should try and root out, has got it backwards. So taking the first part first, what's your favourite example, the most striking demonstration of how wrong we can all be?
Well, there's so many to choose from. That's actually kind of tricky. There's a story that I tell in the book that I quite love, which is about the American preacher William Miller, who in the middle 19th century took it into his head that the world was going to end on October 2nd, 1844. And He managed to amass just a shocking number of followers. We don't know exactly how many, but it was in the many hundreds of thousands, maybe up to 500,000, maybe even more. And they all gathered together on the eve of the ostensible end of the world to await that event. and of course, we all know that it didn't happen. And the reason that I like this story is that, first of all, it's hard to imagine, in a sense, a larger mistake, right? Mm. I mean, you think a really sort of pivotal, once-in-a-lifetime, in fact, once-in-a-kind-of-universe event is going to happen, and then it fails to happen. So in terms of sheer scale, it's kind of hard to outdo it. And then it's also hard to imagine an event that would seem more self-evidently wrong after the fact. Like, there's not really any getting around the fact that the world didn't end. And what's so beautiful and so amazing about this story is that it turns out, no, actually, that's wrong. There is some getting around it. that a great number of the Millerites managed to find a way to defend and maintain their previous belief system, even in the face of really the most kind of stunning and palpable counter-evidence imaginable, i.e. the continued existence of the world as we know it.
And once you start to question how you can be wrong about something as big as that, you see that you can be wrong in all sorts of different ways. Mm-hmm. Your senses or the people you listen to, your reasoning, wrongness pervades everything we do.
I think it does, and that's not to say that we're wrong all the time about everything. Certainly, we are necessarily right about a lot of things or we wouldn't be able to get through daily life. There's this wonderful passage by the philosopher Daniel Dennett. He's talking about one of his very early predecessors, the philosopher Thales, Greek philosopher, who was just kind of from a scientific perspective tremendously wrong about everything. He thought that, you know, I can't even remember. He had some strange theory about water as the essence of the world, and I don't even recall all the details, but suffice it to say they were wrong. And Daniel Dennett points out, well, sure, right? I mean, he was wrong about these big categorical kind of worldview issues. On the other hand, you know, he probably was exactly right about where to buy the best pair of sandals in Athens. You know, there must have been any number of day-to-day things he was right about. And I think it's an important point because I'm not trying to say that we aren't quite often really right about a number of things, mundane things as well as spectacular things. You know, we're a very smart species. But certainly the number of ways that we can err is essentially infinite and does pervade our lives. And our failure to look at and examine those possible avenues of error, I think, can be quite problematic.
So I wanted to ask, what's wrong in the book?
Well, it's an excellent question. And I think there's probably many things wrong with the book. And of course, the nature of wrongness is such that it's hard for me, myself, to know, because I put it in there thinking it's right. But I have had some very alert readers catch a couple of mistakes. The ones that I can remember, I know that I make a kind of silly factual error about an Arctic explorer at some point. I claim that he was most famous for one thing, and that turns out to be not a very good representation of the reality. And then, you know, I also made a mistake that, in retrospect, I'm sort of amazed that I made, and those I think are always more interesting to us. There's a point in the book where I talk about how our minds work, and specifically I'm talking about inductive reasoning and this concept that I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, which is the black swan. There was recently a book by this name that helped make it kind of famous in a contemporary sense, but it's long been a sort of major philosophical idea. And the idea is that how do you know what color swans are? Well, you see a bunch of white swans, and so you assume that all swans are white. And the problem is that every time you see another white swan, you get sort of more evidence for your idea, but you don't get proof of your idea. There's not even, you know, an infinite number of white swans could prove that all swans are white. But a single black swan can prove that your belief about the color of swans is wrong. So for various reasons, this is a famous philosophical idea. And in the book, I chalk it up to David Hume, which is just completely not the case. And what's odd is I sort of knew this, and I've read all the original research on it, and when I sat down to do the writing, and Hume was, I should say, he probably came up with the best and most insightful formulation of inductive reasoning in general, so I'd been writing about that, and just kind of blithely mid-sentence, I attribute this other idea to him, which was completely mistaken, and which, as soon as a reader pointed it out to me, I kind of hit myself on the head and thought.
So for the record, who is it?
For the record, I don't remember. I mean, it's somewhat equally famous, but this is the whole problem, right, is I've now overwritten it with Hume in my head, and I've kind of got my...
He owns that for you now.
Yeah, he owns it for me, and it's one of those funny things where even now that I know that it's a mistake, it's quite hard to dislodge, which is very true to the experience of being wrong, actually. Mm.
But if we're wrong all the time about all sorts of things, then why shouldn't we try our best to just root it out?
Precisely because we're wrong all the time about all sorts of things. You know, rooting out error turns out to be both an impossible pursuit and also an undesirable pursuit. You know, it's not an accident that we have these sort of pat sayings, these cliches like to err is human. Getting things wrong is not the silly little accidental glitch in our system that either evolution or simple hard work is somehow going to remove from the human entity. It's not how that works. We get things wrong for exactly the same reasons that we get things right. We have these very swift, very flexible, incredibly competent minds that are capable of sorting through the sort of dazzling amount of information that's coming at us all the time and reaching very rapid and often very accurate and insightful conclusions. But the very way that we do that, and this is actually where inductive reasoning comes in, the very way that we're able to think about the world in such swift and flexible ways means that inevitably there's a margin of error. If you try to construct a creature that gets things right all the time, it's not going to look anything like a person, and it's not going to be. We've tried to do this with machines, and it turns out they're incompetent at most things. If that's your goal, to simply never get anything wrong, you can do that, but I'm telling you, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So the idea of that eradicating error would somehow make us better and smarter creatures is, could itself not possibly be more mistaken. You know, it would compromise almost everything it means to be human.
You're not suggesting that we should try and accept errors in places like hospitals or when you're trying to fly an airplane.
No, obviously those are domains in which, you know, it's incumbent upon us to do anything in our power to avoid mistakes. But I think the crucial point is that here's how not to pursue that goal. What you don't want to do is cling to this attitude toward error that I'm arguing against. You don't want to act like error is some kind of horrible, embarrassing, kind of negative, aberrational product of a stupid human being, right? As long as you think about error as the consequence of laziness or ignorance or idiocy or irresponsibility, you're never going to create a safer airplane, a safer emergency room. That's simply not how to go about it. And I think the crucial point, and in the book I call this the paradox of error, is that the more important it becomes to not make a mistake, the more deeply you need to accept the likelihood, in fact, the inevitability that you're going to make one. Because it turns out to be the only way to ward them off, right? To really imagine every possible way that you could get something wrong. And instead of trying to avoid those mistakes by just hoping that people will become more perfect, you know, by trying to hire a more perfect pilot or a more perfect surgeon, no, you have to create a more perfect system, which is doable. More perfect people are not doable. But more perfect systems, better and safer systems, are in fact achievable, but only if you think very long and hard about error.
In the book, you argue that there's error is at the heart of art or of comedy. It's something that we should actually celebrate in some way.
There are certain kinds of mistakes that are simply not cause for celebration, to put it mildly. But there are many other respects in which eradicating error is not only impossible, but really is undesirable, because there are certain mistakes that are, first of all, deeply productive, right? That lead to tremendous discoveries, that are, in a sense, in many domains, science, technology. Error is really an incredible engine of innovation and of learning and of change. And of course, we don't want to sacrifice those kinds of mistakes. We would be totally static. We would cut off one of our best ways of advancement.
You also seem to be arguing for the power of beneficial delusions. The story that you tell yourself that the book's going to be done soon helps you finish the book.
Right.
Isn't there a problem there that it's difficult to tell before the fact whether a delusion is beneficial or not?
I suppose. We all suffer from that kind of wrongness as optimism. And I do think it, in a way, I find it quite touching. It's a sort of gesture of faith in ourselves that we really are going to be able to kind of surpass our own limitations and surpass our own expectations. And then more deeply, I think that we need to maintain a certain level of delusion to be happy and functional creatures in the world. And psychologists are very aware of this. In fact, depression is highly correlated, interestingly enough, with being excessively right. Depressives have absolutely no illusions about whether they're going to die, whether they're going to suffer and be in pain, whether they are going to lose friends, whether sickness and suffering are realities in the world.
You can be medically not wrong enough.
Yes, you can be medically not wrong enough, exactly. You can be medically excessively accurate.
Was this a book that made you change your mind about the way you see the world as you were writing it, or did you start off that way?
It's made me much, much better at equally rapidly stepping back and saying, you know what, I have no idea what I'm talking about. Or maybe I'm wrong on this one. You know, I blew it. Sorry, I didn't get it right this time. that all comes much more naturally to me than it used to. And it's a huge relief, I have to say, because it turns out that the ability to step back in that moment, it just makes life just gets instantly so much better. Really, like, you just eliminate so much unnecessary friction. And I find that when I'm able to step back and say that, 80% of the time, so is the other person. It doesn't, you know, every once in a while you get someone who's like, ha, I told you so, you know. But most of the time, the other person is like, well, you know, you might have a point as well. So it changed me in that sense. And then I think probably more importantly, I think I have much more curiosity about and empathy for people I disagree with.
I'm just wondering about your next project. I mean, I guess if we're so wrong about so much, don't we need an account of why we're right about anything at all?
You know, in a sense, I think that this book probably serves some of that purpose. You know, I think that writing about wrongness, in a way, is kind of the flip side of writing about rightness. And there's a lot in the book that either directly or indirectly suggests why we are so able to get so many things right. You know, I talk a lot about the efficacy of the kind of human cognitive system and how it functions. And so I think some of that is already sketched out in the book. I certainly have no intentions of, like, you know, book two being right. You know, that I think I've kind of said my piece on the subject.
Catherine Schultz talking there to Richard Lee. Being Wrong is published by Portobello, and the Guardian First Book Prize will be announced next week. And now from the big questions of science to, well, just really any questions at all. Can that really be all there is in Padgett Powell's new novel, The Interrogative Mood? Can it even be considered a novel? Can a bunch of Londoners give us the answer?
Are your emotions pure? Are your nerves adjustable?
Are your emotions pure? Are your nerves adjustable? How do you stand in relation to the potato? Should it still be Constantinople?
Does a nameless horse make you more nervous or less nervous than a named horse? In your view, do children smell good? If before you now, would you eat animal crackers? Could you lie down and take a rest on a sidewalk? Did you love your mother and father?
If before you now, would you eat animal crackers? I don't know what they are. If you're relegated to last place in every category, are you bothered enough to struggle up? Does your doorbell ever ring? How many push-ups can you do?
Are your emotions pure?
Yes.
Are your nerves adjustable?
The sense that they're not influenced by anything outside of you.
How do you stand in relation to the potato?
It's very tasty to eat in lots of different ways.
Should it still be Constantinople? Does a nameless horse make you more nervous or less nervous than a horse that is named?
I'm not particularly partial to horses anyway.
In your view, do children smell good?
No.
You're really definite.
I am, yeah. I definitely are.
Would you eat animal crackers?
Most certainly not. I don't eat chocolate or biscuits, I'm afraid.
Could you lie down and take a rest on the sidewalk?
Drunk? Depends, yeah. If I was intoxicated, yes. Normally, right now, no, not at all.
What kind of level of intoxication would you have to reach?
We're talking very drunk here. Paralytic.
If you're relegated to last place in every category, are you bothered enough to struggle up?
Yes, completely. Always going to persevere.
Does your doorbell ever ring?
My flatmates often, you know, order things online, they order takeaways, so yeah, I guess so.
In your view, do children smell good?
Could Mendeleev place you correctly in a square?
If you're relegated to last place in every category, are you bothered enough to struggle up? Does your doorbell ever ring?
What do you make of it?
I like it. Is it just a series of questions with no answers?
I don't understand it.
If you're relegated to last place in every category, are you bothered enough to struggle up?
Is there any link between all the questions? Because they seem quite random at the moment.
Why won't the aliens step forth to help us?
Yeah, I'd definitely read it. Sounds interesting.
I mean, when would you read it? Would you read a few of them before you went in bed?
It'd definitely make you think. Some very interesting questions there.
If tennis courts could be of but one surface, which surface should that be?
I'm afraid I'm too tired to answer that or to comprehend the question.
Wow.
Worked that one out yet? Now, Richard, what else should we be looking forward to this week?
Well, of course, the big event next week is the Guardian First Book Prize, which takes place at the Victoria and Albert Museum on Wednesday. But before then, Saturday's Guardian Review will feature the books of the year as selected by John Banville, Julian Barnes, Mary Beard, William Boyd, Anthony Brown, and that's just the bees. Then in the Observer's new review on Sunday, Maureen Freely talks about the neglected art of translation. She's Orhan Pamuk's translator, of course.
And that's all from us this week. Do join us again next week. Meanwhile, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and our producer is Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.